house cleaners, nannies, and cooks, African American domestic workers were often left out of the organized labor movements of the 50s to the 70s and dismissed as unorganizable. But these household workers developed unusual strategies to press for legal recognition of their occupation and dignity for themselves, establishing a movement that endures to this day. We'll hear their story this hour. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, September 9th. We will talk with the author of Household Workers Unite, the untold story of African American women who built a movement. And we'll welcome your thoughts and your questions. And we'll wonder if you are or were a part of the household workers movement. And do you have a story to share about it? Are you or is someone you know a domestic worker? What challenges do household workers face today? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Premila Nadasan, Associate Professor of History at Barnard College, Columbia University. Author of Household Workers Unite, the untold story of African-American women who built a movement. She is also author of the award-winning book, Welfare Warriors, the welfare rights movement in the United States. She works closely with domestic workers' rights organizations, for which she has written policy briefs and served as an academic expert witness. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So why does the history of domestic workers strike a particular chord with you?
Well, I have been interested in African-American women's history for a long time. But more importantly, I live in New York City. And over the past decade and a half, I have observed domestic workers organizing here in New York City. And I was struck by the ways in which there's a vibrant movement of middle-aged women of color in a multiracial organization who have made enormous advances in terms of legislation as well as the ways in which household workers are viewed. And so the real inspiration for this book for me comes from watching and learning from the contemporary movement for domestic worker rights.
Yeah, and also, weren't the women in your family, from your mom to your great-grandmother, all household workers at some point?
Yes, they were. I actually didn't learn that history until I was close to completing the book, and my mother passed away about 10 years ago. So I learned her story from her relatives, from her brother, and from some of my other relatives. And I learned about my grandmother, my father's mother's work as a household worker in South Africa under apartheid from speaking with him. So I began to inquire about this really once I was almost completed with the book, but it was a really an interesting connection and made me feel that I had a personal investment in this book as well.
Yeah. Well, what was life like for the household workers from your mom to your great-grandmother?
I'm sorry?
What was life like for them?
Well, my mother only worked as a household worker for a short period of time before she got married. This was under apartheid in South Africa, and my family is of Indian descent and were brought to South Africa as indentured servants in the late 19th century. And so the men in my family tended to work in the sugarcane fields as indentured workers, and the women tended to work as domestic workers. And life was very difficult for them. They were incredibly impoverished. My mother was a washerwoman, that is, she took in clothing from white families in the area and washed the clothes and then returned the clothing to them. And she did this partly as a way to pay the school fees for her brothers so they could go to school. She herself only managed to get through the eighth grade, in part because she had to drop out and work washing clothing.
Yeah. And what were conditions like for household workers before the household workers movement from the 50s onward?
African-American women, it was an occupation that was tied up with the politics of race in a very powerful way. Most household workers, African-American household workers, and I should say, first of all, that the occupation at the end of the 19th century and the very beginning of the 20th century was very racially diverse occupation. There were a number of European immigrant women who worked as household workers, German women, Irish women. Beginning around World War II, the occupation became dominated by African-American women. That was because of changes in immigration policy that restricted the number of European immigrants who could come into the country. As a result of that, African-American women were encouraged to move from the South, where they had already served as the predominant domestic labor force, to the North, where they also began to dominate the occupation. So for them, the politics of slavery and the history of slavery really shaped their role in the occupation. And the image of the mammy in particular, and the mammy is a stereotype of an African-American woman who is a loyal servant to a white family, who has no needs of her own, who is in fact very content with her work. And this was an image that was popularized in the 1930s with books and films such as Gone with the Wind, mm-hmm. which I think really sort of epitomized the stereotype of the mammy. So it was an occupation that was really shaped by a culture of servitude, a culture in which African American women served white families and were very happy in that occupation. But in fact, we know that that's a stereotype. And there has been a very long history of resistance and organizing by African American domestic workers.
Yeah. Well, what were the? I mean, that was a stereotype. The mammy was not did have needs of her own. What was the life like for the household worker?
Mm-hmm. Many of them were live-in workers. Meaning that they left their own families and they lived with the white family. They had multiple responsibilities, taking care of children, doing house cleaning, very often doing cooking as well. Live-in workers are generally on call. They get room and board, but they really have very little time to themselves. So they might be up at 5 or 6 in the morning to have breakfast ready, to get children ready for their day at school. They work all day long, and they go to bed very late at night. So a live-in worker especially has very little time and space for herself. As African-American women moved from the South to the North, they did increasingly insist on day work. And day work refers to a worker who goes early in the morning and returns to her own home at night. But even in those cases, it's a very long day, getting very little pay, getting no labor protections. In the 1930s, when most of our labor laws were passed, minimum wage legislation, Social Security, unemployment, workers' compensation, household workers were excluded from all of these labor rights, as were other occupations as well, such as agricultural workers. And the politics of race were really central to why they were excluded from these labor protections. There were discussions in Congress about whether or not to include domestic workers in the labor protections, and congressmen decided not to. And the labor movement itself never lobbied for the inclusion of these particular workers either.
Why not?
I think the labor movement was centered on a particular model of what labor meant and a particular model of labor organizing. Domestic work, in many ways, was considered outside the boundaries of labor. It is work that takes place in the privacy of the home. So in some ways, it's invisible work. It is work that women have done for centuries and continue to do, very often without pay. So in that way, there's a kind of a fuzzy line between paid and unpaid household work. And it's an occupation that has been devalued because of the particular kinds of people who make up the workforce, immigrant women, women of color, and African-American women. And so all of this has devalued household labor and I think pushed it to the margins of how we understand or think about labor. And I think these broader cultural assumptions informed labor leaders. That is, it was not necessarily that they deliberately excluded household work the way that congressmen did, but I think it was never in their frame of reference to think about domestic work as real work.
We're going to check news from Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking with the author of Household Workers Unite. And welcome your questions. First, this news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Premila Nadasen, Associate Professor of History at Barnard College. She is the author of Household Workers Unite, an untold story of African American women who built a movement. The untold story of African American women who built a movement. And we are welcoming your questions and your own experiences. Are you or were you a part of the household workers movement? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, let's talk now about the key figures in this movement, Professor Nadasen.
Yes, there were a number of African American women who were central to household worker organizing from the 1950s to the 1970s. Dorothy Bolden was one of the most important women. She was a household worker in Atlanta and had been working as a domestic worker since about the age of 9. And Dorothy Bolden was immersed in the civil rights movement. She lived fairly close to the area where Martin Luther King lived, and she knew King. She was involved in desegregation efforts of the public schools in Atlanta and worked closely with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee there. And as a household worker, Bolden began to think about the ways in which this influenced her occupation. And actually, shortly before King died, she told him that she thought that somebody needs to organize domestic workers as well. And King told her that she ought to do it. And so that's precisely what she set out to do. She wrote a number of leaflets. She wrote in Atlanta. African-American women who were domestic workers would usually in the morning board the buses on their way downtown to transfer to buses that would then take them out to the white suburbs of Atlanta where they worked all day. And Bolden knew the bus routes that these women rode, and so she rode with them, talking to them about the need for domestic workers to organize. And so she eventually developed a citywide organization in Atlanta called the National Domestic Workers Union of America, which was not a national organization. It was a citywide organization, and demanded that domestic workers in Atlanta be paid a minimum wage of $15 a day plus car fare. And that there be a standard contract written for domestic workers. There was another woman in Cleveland, Ohio, Geraldine Roberts, who worked as a household worker in Shaker Heights. And she began to talk to the two other women who worked in the same household where she was employed about the ways in which their employer expected them to work all day for very little pay, would not allow them to speak to one another, maintained enormous control over their day-to-day actions, required them to use a separate bathroom, separate eating utensils. And Roberts collected $1 from each of her coworkers, and she decided to start her own organization in Cleveland as well. Another household worker, Geraldine Miller, in New York City, was riding a commuter train on her way out to work when another organizer approached her and began to talk about the possibility of fringe benefits for domestic workers. And Miller had never heard of fringe benefits for domestic workers. She knew there were other workers that had fringe benefits. And so she, that idea really stuck in her head, and she decided herself that she wanted to begin to organize other workers. And she wrote up a leaflet, which she passed out at the bus stops and the train stations. And she encouraged the women who she knew to attend a national conference of domestic workers that was being held in Washington, D.C. in 1971. And she got some funds from the National Urban League to rent a bus and to take a group of women down there. Mm-hmm. And all of these women, I think, represent the ways in which this movement really emerged from the grassroots. With really ordinary women who were employed as household workers who began to think in the context of the civil rights movement and labor organizing and the women's movement, think about the ways in which their very own lives were shaped by the politics of race, class, and gender, and how they could begin to organize. And they eventually came together into a national formation, which they call the Household Technicians of America, that had a membership of 25,000 women nationwide, which is actually quite a large membership. Yeah. If we think about at an organization like SDS, for example, Students for Democratic Society, that at its peak had about 30,000 members.
Didn't Rosa Parks also contribute to this movement?
There were women in Montgomery, Alabama, who were involved in the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. Now, the Montgomery bus boycott lasted for 1 year, and of course was initiated by Rosa Parks' refusal to give up her seat on the bus. Most of the women who participated in the bus boycott that made it successful were domestic workers, and that sometimes is not. That fact is not highlighted enough in that history. Had it not been for domestic workers, the bus boycott would not have been a success. So Georgia Gilmore was one of the women in Montgomery, Alabama, who had heard of Rosa Parks' arrest and decided to participate in the boycott. What Georgia Gilmore did is she decided to raise money in support of the boycott. So she spoke to a number of other domestic workers, and they began to cook food. So they made chicken sandwiches, and they baked pies, and they baked cakes. And they sold the food to people in their community, in their neighborhood. And they managed to, every week, donate hundreds of dollars to the cause of the boycott. Gilmore was eventually blacklisted. She was fired from her job. She couldn't find work. So Martin Luther King helped her remodel her kitchen to allow her to cook out of her kitchen and to serve food. So she eventually opened up a small restaurant in her own house and served food that way. And her home actually became a meeting ground for civil rights activists because it was a safe space where they could meet and talk about political strategy.
And here's something I did not know. Well, I did not know a lot of things about this movement, but the household workers movement did have success in Wisconsin in terms of the minimum wage.
Yes, it did. Domestic workers, as I mentioned before, were excluded from the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938 because of the politics of race. And that exclusion obviously meant that they weren't entitled to minimum wage. There were certain states that did, in fact, give domestic workers minimum wage, and that had to do with lobbying on the part of labor feminists through the 1940s and the 1950s. But it was this movement, really, that pushed for and supported the minimum wage legislation that was being discussed in Congress in the 1970s. And domestic workers did, in fact, get federal minimum wage protection in 1974.
Yeah. Does it exist today?
Domestic workers cannot legally form a union. They were also excluded from the National Labor Relations Act and are still excluded from the National Labor Relations Act. So they don't have the legally protected right to form a union the way many other workers do. But they have formed social movement organizations, advocacy organizations, domestic worker rights groups. And because of that, I think because of their exclusions from the National Labor Relations Act, they have developed very innovative labor organizations that have used social movement strategies. That is, it's more akin to civil rights organizing and feminist organizing than it is to labor organizing. They have instituted, the movement has emerged, for example, from worker centers. Worker centers are sites of labor organizing that include people who are employed in multiple occupations. It's based on people who live in a particular neighborhood. Rather than organizing against particular employers or individual employers, the movement has advocated state-based legislation, legislation that would protect workers regardless of their employer and regardless of whether they are organized or not organized. They have advocated for professionalization and dignity. They have decided to organize in public spaces. So much of the organizing takes place on city buses or in public parks. So the exclusions from the National Labor Relations Act, I think, has created a kind of social movement unionism that allows the movement to have a broader reach than a more focused labor union that is tied to a employer.
So what successes have they had as a result of this organizing?
The contemporary movement has passed a number of states' bills of rights. New York State was the first to pass a Bill of Rights in 2010, and that Bill of Rights establishes a series of regulations, including basic minimum wage payment, including 2 weeks off per year, including a certain number of sick days, minimum standards for live-in workers. And New York State really sort of set the stage for other states to consider bills of rights as well. So as of right now, there are 5 states across the country that have passed bills of rights, and there are other states that are considering this kind of legislation. The other important victory has been the inclusion of home health care workers in federal minimum wage legislation. In 1974, when domestic workers were included in federal minimum wage laws, the Department of Labor excluded home health care workers. Today, it's one of the largest growing occupations, one of the fastest growing occupations in the country. So home health care workers, and these are women who are employed by state agencies or nonprofit agencies to go out to private homes to take care of the elderly or the disabled. They very often do cleaning. They do some health care. They might do bathing. They administer medications. Mm-hmm. They're very often workers who are employed for 12 hours a day, and they work on shifts. Home health care workers were excluded from federal minimum wage protections until very recently. The Obama administration instituted a rule about 3 years ago that gave the Department of Labor the authority to include this particular group of workers. There was a struggle in the courts, and just very recently that was resolved. And so now home health care workers are, in fact, protected by the federal minimum wage.
Is the Bill of Rights, the state-wide Bill of Rights that New York passed, is that under consideration in Wisconsin?
I'm not exactly sure of the status of that in Wisconsin at the moment.
Yeah, you though, of the states that are considering it, you don't believe Wisconsin is one of them.
I don't believe it is, no.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should ask our listeners, should Wisconsin adopt a Bill of Rights for household workers? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is the author of Household Workers Unite, the Untold Story of African-American Women Who Built a Movement. We are talking about that movement, which does endure to this day. And we are welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your thoughts on this. Are you a household worker? Are you or someone you know a domestic worker? What challenges do household workers face? And what protections do they need today? And what can we learn from this movement that was built by African American women in the 50s to the 70s? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I know, Premila, that you think that there are a lot of myths and misconceptions about domestic workers that you would like to set straight. What are some of the biggest ones?
I think the biggest one is probably the assumption that domestic workers are unorganizable, that they are vulnerable, that they are victims of an occupation. And I think there's a certain grain of truth to that. The occupation is one that does, in fact, work to disempower women. The labor legislations that are currently in place are very often not enforced. We have an occupation, especially today, that is very often populated by undocumented immigrants who might not know their rights or might not have access to an advocacy organization. I think, however, that assumption of domestic workers as unorganizable erases the very long history of organizing and the ways in which domestic workers have challenged the power of their employers. This sometimes happens in what historians refer to as a kind of day-to-day resistance, sort of carving out spaces of autonomy within your day to assert yourself and take control over the work process. But more importantly, I think it's the very long history of organizing that we've seen in this occupation, both by immigrant domestic workers today, as well as historically by African American workers. So in 1881, for example, there were washerwomen, that is, women who washed laundry in Atlanta, who organized a citywide strike and nearly shut the city of Atlanta down. In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, there were a number of domestic worker organizations, some of them called themselves unions, that organized, including one in New York City that was led by a woman named Dora Jones, and they had 1,000 members in New York City at that time. And then this movement that I write about in the post-war period. So I think there, has been a great deal of organizing by domestic workers, despite the fact that they have been marginalized by the labor movement and not been recognized, I think, by historians.
Our guest is Premila Nadasan. She is an associate professor of history at Barnard College, Columbia University, and she is the author of Household Workers Unite, The Untold Story of African American Women Who Built a Movement. We welcome your questions for her about this movement then and now. And we wonder if you have a story to share as perhaps a member of this household workers movement. Are you a domestic worker today? Do you think that more protections are needed for domestic workers, for that matter, for home health care workers? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'll check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will continue our discussion. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Premila Nadasan. She is an associate professor of history at Barnard College, Columbia University, and author of Household Workers Unite, The Untold Story of African-American Women Who Built a Movement. We are talking about that movement as house cleaners or nannies or cooks. African-American domestic workers were often left out of the organized labor movements of the 50s to the 70s and dismissed as unorganizable, also not considered, the work wasn't necessarily considered real labor. But these household workers developed unusual strategies to press for legal recognition of their occupation, and they established a movement that endures to this day. We are hearing about that movement and wondering if you are a domestic worker. What challenges do domestic workers today face? Are they treated fairly, or do they need more legal protections? What can movements like the domestic workers teach about effective organizing around human and labor rights? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Gail on Facebook writes, are there any figures on what percentage of American households back then had domestic help and what the income of those households was? I wonder because I have an old cookbook of my grandma's from the late 1940s, and there was a section on how to serve guests with a maid, and it certainly wasn't a fancy cookbook, and my grandmother certainly didn't have a maid. So I guess back then, any idea how common it was for American households to have domestic help?
It's very difficult to find statistics on that, and I have searched far and wide. Statistics were not kept about employers the way they were kept about domestic workers. The other thing that makes it difficult to know how many households employed domestic workers is that many domestic workers worked in more than one household. So we don't actually have statistics about that. And even the number of domestic workers itself is a very difficult figure to nail down, because many workers were employed under the table and didn't report their earnings, and households didn't report their earnings either. So it's very difficult to actually have to know the statistics about that. In the 1940s, however, it was fairly common even for middle-class households and even some working-class households to employ domestic workers. So it was fairly widespread, both in the North as well as in the South.
Do we have any idea how many households have domestic workers today?
We don't have any idea about that. Again, partly because so much of this work is unreported. There are estimates that there are 2 million domestic workers today, but again, we don't know how many of those workers are working in more than one household.
Yeah, and where is the domestic worker movement today?
There is a National Domestic Workers Alliance that was formed in 2007. There are something like 30 local domestic worker organizations around the country, all over the country, California, in Northern California, in Oakland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Texas, New York, of course, Atlanta. And this national federation, this national organization, is also part of an international federation of domestic worker organizations. So part of what I think is so fascinating about this movement is the ways in which it has also developed alliances with groups that are in other parts of the world. This is really a global problem, and I think the question of domestic work and household labor becomes exacerbated with income inequality. That is, as there are more and more, as there is a bigger gap between the rich and the poor, the rich are more able to hire someone to outsource the household labor. They hire somebody to do the cleaning, they hire somebody to do the cooking, and they hire people to take care of the children. So the question of domestic labor and the number of domestic workers increases as income inequality increases as well. And so that's part of the reason why there's been a global movement for domestic worker rights, which actually passed in 2011 a Convention on Domestic Work through the International Labor Organization, which is a United Nations body. And that Convention on Domestic Work is essentially a body of regulations or standards that countries ought to abide by to regulate domestic work. Now, countries have to ratify the convention and then have to enforce the convention, and not all countries, and the United States has not yet ratified it. There have been about 30 countries around the world that have ratified it. So it has not been ratified by all countries and still has to be enforced. But I think that convention is nevertheless important because what it does is it sets a series of global standards for this occupation.
Yeah, let's go to Libby in Madison. Hello, Libby.
Hi. Say, I just wanted to add that I have an aunt who's in her 80s, and she tells stories often about when she was a teenager and her family being poor, and they kind of found a job for her as live-in domestic help, and they kind of deposited her there, and she worked for several months, maybe even years, taking care of the house, making the food, tutoring the kids, making sure they got off to school, and doing all that, and also trying to squeeze in her own education. So I'd heard the question or comment about, you know, how do we know historically how much domestic help was used? And my thought is, you know, it might also be difficult to track because was it always adult women? You know, if it was kids, it might not be even have risen to the, you know, kind of people's radars.
Mm-hmm. Pramila?
That's a very good point. And in fact, there were many, many of the women who I write about started doing domestic work at the age of 9, and they might have been doing it for 3 or 4 hours a day at that young age. But obviously, there are no statistics that are kept about that. And certainly in earlier periods, there were children who were employed as domestic workers.
So what do the women that you highlight in the book have to teach and or inspire current and future generations?
You know, one of the things about this movement that I find so fascinating is that they were really organizing a precarious workforce, that is, a workforce that had very few federal labor protections, that did not have protection of civil rights laws, that worked part-time, that were considered quote-unquote independent contractors. They really are the contingent workers that we hear so much about today. And I think there are larger, there is a larger and larger percentage of the American workforce that is contingent workers. According to a report by the Government Accounting Office that was just released in May of this year, 40% of American workers are contingent. And it's happening not just in this kind of service industry, but even large corporations like Google are increasingly outsourcing certain aspects of their work and hiring independent contractors. Uber drivers, I think, are another sort of category of work that is also contingent workers, or adjunct faculty at universities, nail salon workers, home health care workers. And in all of these categories, workers are not guaranteed minimum wage, or if they are, it's rarely enforced. They very often get no Social Security benefits, no paid vacations, no sick leave, no health benefits. And what I think that domestic workers can teach us is how to organize this contingent workforce. These women were organizing in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, but the models of organizing that they established then, that is to organize workers regardless of their employer, to organize workers regardless of their immigration status, to include workers who were undocumented or who didn't have legal status, I think offers us a way to think about developing a new labor movement.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if some people think that today conditions aren't so bad for domestic workers. What are some of the hardships for domestic workers today, or these contingent or contract workers?
In some ways, the issues haven't changed all that much. There is still a problem of underpayment. According to a recent report that was produced by the National Domestic Workers Alliance, 23% of domestic workers are paid less than minimum wage. 70% of them are paid less than $13 an hour. Now, I think we know that minimum wage doesn't always translate into a living wage. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology did a report recently where they figured out the living wage for various areas of the country. In New York, they calculated that the living wage for one adult and one child would be $27 an hour. And the minimum wage in New York State is $8.75. So there is a real discrepancy there between what it costs for families to live and what workers are paid. So about 20% of domestic workers reported that in the previous month they did not have enough money to purchase food for their family. So conditions for domestic workers are still very trying. The question of financial security is one that is persistent for household workers, as well as the questions of how they take care of their own children. Some domestic workers have children who are living and they find it difficult to find childcare. And other domestic workers are what we call transnational mothers. That is, they are foreign workers who have families in another part of the world.
And I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time. I want to thank you, Premila Nadasen, for being with us, author of Household Workers Unite. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Feeling lucky? Your contribution at WPR.org right now automatically enters you in our fall sweepstakes. You could win an iPad, a $400 Amazon gift card, a bed and breakfast stay, or other great prizes. Entering the sweepstakes is easy and no contribution is necessary. Go to WPR.org/sweepstakes to see the full prize list and the fine print. Good luck.